Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. The show is sponsored by Savage Classical. That's savageclassical.com, S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. You can go there and Richard will hook you up. Just tell him I sent you. That's savageclassical.com for all your guitar needs, in particular, if you're looking to buy a new guitar. I know I am. I've been wanting to buy a guitar for years. I just can't justify it because we don't get paid very much to play these things. So it's a labor of love. And, I'm not sure why we do this, but we do it. And it's something that we interact with every day. That's sort of my thing when I'm talking about spending a lot of money. I'm like, how often am I interacting with it? So I spend a lot of money on my phone, right? I have an iPhone. I consider $1,000 for an iPhone a lot of money. All the iPhones are essentially, I mean, mine wasn't. Mine was like $650 or $7. I got the little mini one. But it's something I'm going to interact with every day. And if it can make, if it's just something kind of pretty to look at, shiny. I hope that there's more to these $12,000 guitars than just being pretty to look at. I don't know if I have the best ear. I don't know why I'm doing this. I'm just tearing down savageclassical.com, which you should totally visit. They're our longest sponsor. You should go. A lot of you do, and I appreciate it. But I don't always hear the difference. Is that okay to say? I'm not trying to be, look, most of you listening are maybe a lot more intelligent than me in that way. But I sometimes, I got somebody who just got a new guitar and like a student, and it was really expensive. And I played it and I was like, yeah, all right, it's good. But I don't know. It's probably like anything else. That's like TVs. Like if you go from a high definition television or whatever, and then you go down to a lower one, then you notice it after you spent some time with the nice thing, right? I don't know. I don't know why these things got so complicated and expensive. Everything is just, they're really taking it out of our ass these days. But you know who won't take it out of your ass? SavageClassical.com. S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. Make sure you go to Rosetta. Actually, I'm not even going to bother with the rosettapodcast.com/insider. You could do it if you want. That's like Rosetta Stone for like a discount. I don't even know what it does anymore. I haven't checked in with them for a while. But, how about the last big read for rosettapodcast.com/insider? Go there and you can get a, you can learn a language of your choice. Whatever you want. You can learn anything for $200, or you can pick one language and one only. And for $8 a month, you can learn it. That's rosettapodcast.com/insider. Don't go to rosettastone.com. Nobody goes there anymore. Okay, so let's get on with the show. Today, we have a very special guest, a man who is very influential on my compositions. If you listen to me, you're listening to a little bit of this guy in there. It's Andrew York. This is great. We had Fred Hand on last week, and we have Andrew York on this week. And look at this. It's a little composer's corner going on here. Not a classical guitar corner. That's Simon. Copyright. Simon Powis. He's a good friend of mine. I don't know why I'm making fun of the way he sounds. That's not even the way he sounds. He doesn't sound like the baby from the cartoon baby from the Family Guy. Stewie. Simon doesn't sound like Stewie from Family Guy. Anyway, Andrew York is on the show today, and he has something that we forgot to talk about because him and I both just abhor anything having to do with promotion or any of that kind of stuff. But he has this wonderful site that he's letting me use for a couple of months here. That's not why I'm having him on the show. We ended up talking about it afterwards. But this is like what he's doing. This is like... Probably should have spent more time talking about it, but I said that I'd talk about it in the intro, and I'm glad I did because I went and I visited it. I watched it for about an hour today. What it is called Andrew's Den, andrewsden.com. This is like how he's teaching now. He's retired from in-person lessons in California colleges, which he was at for the majority of his life, and now he's getting this off the ground. People are responding well to it. It is, you basically become a member at andrewsden.com and you have just all of his, a wealth of his knowledge is there. He basically is, the two videos, I watched two videos. I watched Works, which goes over his poem number 4. And he sort of tells you about the influences behind it, the counterpoint, the importance of bringing out the different voices and how that can sort of give a three-dimensional quality to the listener that they aren't even aware of. There's a lot there. You know, if you're gonna be playing his pieces, this is a must have. And also just kind of, you know, you kind of get an idea for the breadth of his compositions rather than just what we've been exposed to. The other thing is that, what else did I watch? I watched, Proprioception. I explained to Andrew in the podcast that I don't read very well. I think I read okay, but I don't know. I see Liz, my fiance Liz, right? You guys know I'm getting married. That's pretty cool, right? Anyway, so she's sitting there. I don't like that word fiance though. We don't know what to call each other right now. Maybe you guys can, we're not boyfriend and girlfriend anymore. Anyway, she reads books. She goes to the library and like finishes 3 books a week, it seems like. It takes me a month. I'm reading Norman Mailer right now. Executioner's Song. Jesus, that's a good book. What a terrible person who wrote a wonderful book. Why does this happen? Why are there Wagners and Norman Mailers and Louis C.K.'s out there? What is going on? Anyway, let's talk more about this. Uh-oh, there's my neighbor. I have this guy who works next to me. And I just heard him get up. And we both have our offices in the same thing. I hope he didn't. It's so embarrassing. When I was on the Upper East Side, I just didn't give a shit. And I used to just say whatever I wanted because it was just Gail Peters. That's what her name was. She was a little old lady that lived next to me. And I knew her. And, you know, I didn't care what she heard. Now these are all like, I don't know, like surrounded by crazy. The Upper East Side was a long time ago. That was like 10 years ago now, right? Okay, anyway. But still getting over that move. Proprioception and mental mapping. All right. I watched about a 30-minute video on that today. It was very helpful, especially with my dystonia. It was huge. I mean, it wasn't huge. You know, nothing's huge with dystonia. Dystonia is what it is. And, you know, there's no, you know, one-stop shop for that. And this video wasn't even about that, but I sort of used it for a couple of passages that I was struggling with, and it helped. So he'll tell you all about that. I don't want to give it away, right? Proprioception and mental mapping. So those are the two videos that I watched, and both of them were great. Go to andrewsden.com. and become a member. I don't know. Maybe he'll become a sponsor. We'll see. I don't need him to sponsor me. I'll just help him out. Just joking. If you want to get your stuff sponsored, just like Savage Classical and Andrew, and last week we had the Florida Guitar Festival, make sure that you go to brettwilliamsmusic.com/support, and you can just support the show out of the goodness of your heart, or you can email me at brett@brettwilliamsmusic.com and I can give a shout out to whatever project you're doing. Depending on what you want me to do, it'll cost more money than you might be comfortable spending, or just not that much at all. If you just want me to talk about something real quick, like the Florida thing, that's not that much money. If you want me to interview you or play your music, it becomes kind of a thing. Anything, anyway. So that's what Andrew's doing, but we had, a really, really good conversation. I feel back, you know, I feel like I'm back. And last week with Fred, I'm glad you guys stuck with me. It was the first time I interviewed somebody for the second time. Is this going? Am I even recording? Yes, I am, right? Okay, anyway, that was the first time I've interviewed somebody since, you know, in like 3 or 4 months. It was, you know, we had a huge break there with me doing the summer camp that I work at and stuff, right? And all the other stuff, the recording, everything else. It was just a lot. Now we're back. I feel comfortable. I feel comfortable with the intro. I feel comfortable. I felt incredibly comfortable talking to Andrew, but that's just because of the person that he is. You know, this is a kind of a guitar hero of mine, I'd say, in a lot of ways. Just especially since I started composing. It's, you know, you got to look at him as, I think I say during the podcast that I think he's composed more than anybody else. If somebody else has composed more, that I'm a little bit unaware of it. I just don't see anybody for this amount of time doing this much. I don't know. for the guitar from a compositional standpoint. Maybe Brouwer. Maybe. I don't know. I'm an idiot. So fill me in. And if you're going to fill me in and tell me what to do, make sure you support the show by going to brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. Anyway, let's get on with it. Let's talk to Andrew York. You're from Virginia, right? Is that, essentially, that's where you were raised.
Yeah, that's right. In Richmond.
In Richmond. All right. So what was the guitar scene like over there? Was it?
Well, I was, I left when I was just about to turn 12. And actually, I did a study there with a wonderful woman named Greta Dalitz. I miss her very much, from Germany. She had the longest running radio show of any classical guitarist. I can't remember the name of her show now, but it went forever. And she was my teacher. She studied with Aaron Shearer. And I started when I was, I don't know, 7 or 8, something like that, with her. And she just gave me a really good foundation. Wonderful lady. And she had a daughter my age who I was really enamored with. Very cute, I remember.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine, yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of people, you know, they probably don't put Richmond, Virginia together with Peabody, but that's true. It's right there. So that whole Aaron Shearer scene is, you know, an hour out from.
That's right. And then when I moved to Northern Virginia, I did go up. My mother would drive me to Bethesda, Maryland, and I studied with Ray Chester, who taught at Peabody forever. I think he retired not so long ago. But by that time, I was a teenager. And I was mostly interested in rock and roll and motorcycles. And, you know, I had a huge Ampeg V4 stack, and I was playing in bars by the time I was like 16. And so I wasn't the best student of classical at that time. You know, it kind of came in and out for a period as hormones kicked in. But I still always played. I never stopped playing with nails and playing classical. But then I got, of course, serious a year or two later again.
I mean, that's the kind of the thing that, you know, runs through your music is the eclectic nature of it. The fact that you are not just a classical guitarist. I mean, a lot of people might not know this because I was exposed to you as a kid. I'm 45, and I was exposed to you because of the John Williams album and the Sunburst on his guitar, the Americas album, and that composition of your Summer. But you actually play it, when you play it on your solo album, you're playing it on steel strings.
Yeah, so that was 1986, just to quickly preface that. I had just got my master's degree at USC. I'd moved out to California, and I was coming out of playing many different styles. I was actually studying jazz primarily. I was doing actually classical and jazz at USC. My degree was in studio guitar, which was supposed to be all styles in preparation for studio work. But what it really meant is you studied jazz with the best jazz players around. Like I studied with Lenny Breaux and Joe DiOrio. Incredible time. And I was also studying classical with Jim Smith. And when I made the record right after graduating, Perfect Sky, that has Sunburst on it, it has three pieces on electric guitar that are done pretty much classically, you know, finger style. One was Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, a solo guitar arrangement of that. Wickedly difficult, but really interesting to hear. So three electric guitar pieces, one steel, which was Sunburst, which I always play on nylon. But at that time, I was still playing some steel string. You know, my main instrument was nylon, always was, but I was doing a lot of electric with jazz and still a bit of steel. And after that, I kind of really heavily focused. I sold my electrics and I still only have one steel string that was my father's that I rarely play. But, I always loved the sound of nylon string, just the beauty and warmth of that sound. That was what called to me. So I really, over time, after deep experimentation and deep immersion in multiple styles, which was invaluable to me as a composer and player, I really focused back again, you know, on solo nylon string guitar. And that's where I've been ever since, some mid-20s.
And when you were studying, so you didn't study with Pepe with the rest of the quartet then, right?
He wasn't. He was no longer at USC then, but all the other members of the quartet, or two of them, studied with Pepe. John studied with Celine, but the other was a heavy Romero influence, but that was mostly gone when I was there. And besides, I was in the studio guitar department. But Jim Smith was teaching classical, and so was Bill Kanigheiser, you know, who I ended up playying with. But I studied with Jim.
As far as
great.
That might have sounds. It's, yeah, man. As far as like that degree is concerned, it's called studio guitar.
That was what it was called. It's still there. They have a huge studio guitar program, and they have, again, some of the most interesting players of all styles teaching there. I think Adam Del Monte teaches flamenco and Larry Prince on jazz, and it run by Richard Smith, the guy that came to USC the same year I did in 1983. He was another grad student. He came down from Oregon, and I came out from Virginia, and we were populating the graduate program for studio guitar.
Going back to Virginia and being in Richmond, and you said you were playing in bands and bars and stuff like that.
That was Northern Virginia. That was high school. I left Richmond when I was 12, essentially. So yeah.
Where'd you go?
Northern Virginia. I moved to up about a half an hour south of D.C.
And then because you also went to school out here too, right? Isn't James
Madison?
My
undergraduate was James Madison, exactly.
What was that? Did you do undergraduate in guitar, or were you doing something completely different?
This is actually a very funny story to which I did not know the answer until a few years ago. Approaching, my late 50s, I finally found out what happened. It's kind of bizarre. So I'll tell it. So it's
please do.
Because most people don't know this, because I could never answer how this happened. It makes me look kind of ridiculous. So I auditioned for James Madison on guitar. I remember what I played, various pieces, some Tara guy, even played Mood for a Day, at the time. I transcribed it like everybody did at the time, the Yes piece, Steve Powell, and various classical repertoire. And they said, great, you're in, you're coming to JMU. So I passed the audition and I was admitted. So a few months go by, I show up, my parents bring me, and I'm alone on campus, living in the dorms. I walk across campus with my guitar case the first day of classes and show up to the music department. And my question is, where's the guitar department? Well, we don't have one. So what do you mean you don't? Yeah, it's like, I'm just, maybe I wasn't the most like grounded and focused at that time. I was kind of head in the clouds all the time. But so this would be somewhat typical. So I thought, how can this be? I auditioned on guitar and was accepted.
They were like, nobody told you to play guitar.
yeah, they're like, oh, this was hilarious. So they send me to this great guy, like Joe Estock. He was the head of the music department. He's like, well, they're trying to figure this out. He goes, well, do you play anything else? And I said, well, I play some flute. I was not real good, but I played some flute.
Yeah, they probably only had like a marching band or something, right? They don't have.
Yeah, well, actually, they had really good faculty, and there was a wealth of talent at the time among the students. I mean, a lot of my friends from that time went on to have major careers. A lot of them in the country industry in Nashville. It's like some play with a lot of a lot of people did well. It was a huge pool of talent at that time. Anyway, they said, well, flute then, maybe you can be a flute major. So I ended up being a flute major in my first year with wonderful teacher Carol Kniebisch, and I worked very, very hard. And I continued to play guitar constantly. I was backing up the singers and the flute players doing Dowland and things like that. And so I was constantly playing. And so the school, and there was one other guy who wanted to major if a teacher could be found. So the school was kind of shamed, and they actually created the program. And I hired the teacher as a freshman because they would do auditions and there would be the entire faculty, some nervous applicant, and me. They'd tell me, be in room 302 or whatever at 12:30. So I'd come in there, this green freshman, my thick glasses on, and this guy would play, and then they would listen, and then they'd kick him out, and they'd all turn to me, what do you think? Because they knew nothing about classical guitar, the cellist, the violinist, the piano teacher, all of them. What do you think? And I'd say, well, I don't know. And then so finally,
and you're like 19 years old. You're like 18. You're like a child.
I think I was just 18. I just turned 18. I started when I was.
What do you think about this guy?
Yeah. So finally, one guy said, yeah, he's good. I like the way he plays. I could learn from him. They said, we'll hire him. So he got the job. Now, the next year, I switch my major to guitar. So that's okay. So now cut to why I could never explain this bizarre situation. Decades later, I'm at this party, an old reunion with some friends, and they invited Joe Estock, who was the head of the music department at that time. Mm-hmm. And I was telling that story, we were telling funny stories of the past, like how you showed up and with your guitar and there was no guitar program. And I said, I still can't understand. And Joe Estock said, I know why. And I'm like, You do? Why? He goes, okay, here's why. So he was in an elevator at maybe an ASTA convention or one of these music conferences. And into the elevator comes my band director from high school, Ed Jones. Wonderful guy. We got along so well, and he was so good to me. He kind of helped me in so many ways. And he had a lot of faith in my musical abilities. And he cornered Joe Estock in the elevator and said, there's a guy that's going to audition for you on guitar. Accept him, no matter what. Just accept him. And the guy said, we don't have a guitar player. He says, nope, just take him. Just do it, okay? And Estock said, okay.
So this was legit. No one told you this.
No one told me this. I had no idea. And if they did, I certainly have no... That's the kind of thing you would tend to remember if someone told you. So anyway... Mystery solved. So thanks to my band director, I wish he was still alive, so I thank him once again. But just because that was a formative thing. So yeah, I got my degree in 3 years instead of four, because I only had three to do the work, because I spent the first year studying flute. And I continued, I minored in flute, piano, and upright bass, double bass, and then just switched the bass to guitar major. Yeah, it was cool.
Oh, I mean, that is cool, because that also must have been very, you know, you're 18 and you think you're going into this guitar program. You think you're going to have to buckle down, get into guitar. This is what you're doing. And then all of a sudden, no, you got to think outside the box. You're being asked to audition other students, to pick a teacher, to do all these things, and to play bass and to play flute. So this is all sort of, this must have crystallized into sort of what you've become. Which is not really a multi-instrumentalist at all, but just all these different influences and all these different things that go into your music, and the need to constantly change and to shift and to grow and to, you don't seem afraid to move from one thing to another, to leave the most successful guitar ensemble in the world. Right, that doesn't, these kinds of things are things that a lot of people wouldn't do if maybe they didn't have those experiences when they were, you know, in those formative years as an artist, you know?
Well, many people at that, when I said I'm leaving, because I, you know, that was an amicable parting with the quartet, and I gave them more than a year's notice to find someone else. Mm-hmm. But many people were thinking, you sure you want to do this? You know? Yeah. Even I was doing some recording with Andy Summers at the time, and he goes, I don't know if I'd leave that group if I were you. You know, you just want a Grammy and just everything. Like, no, I there's other things I want to do. I've done this now for, you know, 15 years or whatever. I don't want to do this anymore. It was as great as it was, and as grateful as I am for the experience, and we did so much great music together. But I didn't want to do that for my life. That was sort of one thing I could do, and I, you know, wanted to branch out into other things. But yeah, I think in retrospect, majoring in flute for that year was incredible. I mean, I learned so much, of course, about breath. And the one thing guitarists don't have. And also with the upright bass, with bow, which is an analog of breath, anything you do to sustain an instrument, if you're not using your breath, you know, like singing or trumpet or flute, you're using a bow for most instruments, which is an analog of breathing to sustain. Guitarists don't have that. And often, even very fine guitarists have, I think, a limited apprehension of how to play in a way that's analogous to breathing. The really fine ones do, but I think that's a very difficult thing to obtain. And I think I was very lucky to have that at a pretty young age, you know, to really deeply study, you know, with a master flautist. Well, a fun thing recently, I just did this, kind of woke up one day and started improvising. I listened to a tape of an improvisation I'd done that was strumming, and I built within 2 days this whole piece around it kind of in my mind, and I just pulled every instrument I had out of my closet, including flute, and made this YouTube video called Play Everything. And it was really interesting. I don't play flute much anymore, but I spent like those 2 days kind of practicing the melody, you know, remembering how to do it. And my wife and I filmed the video after I'd recorded all the tracks. So that kind of really just recently kind of reawakened that time as I kind of worked hard, especially in the upper register, to get these passages on flute down. Yeah, that was nice.
I mean, the good thing about the flute is that it's a C instrument, and then the bass is tuned like the guitar. So they all kind of, you know, they're all sort of informing each other a little bit, right? I mean, you can sort of read the same notes and play the same things and sort of build your fingers in the same way. I mean, I've always wanted to play, you know, I used to call it upright bass, I guess.
That's what I still call it. In jazz days.
Jazz bass. But so it's well, that is, I think that's really interesting. You're sitting there and you're at this university that has no guitar department. Who'd you end up going with? Who was the teacher? I don't know if you told me or if I missed it or.
I didn't
who
say.
Who ended up being the professor?
So the professor was Peter Miller, and he was a good player. He taught me a lot about phrasing. He wasn't the strongest player in the world, but he had worked hard. He was a young man at the time, and I don't know. He didn't teach there, I think, that long after I left. He was there for a number of years, but not so long. He kind of tried to move into the country realm, more producing and things like that. That was his interest. But at the time, that was very helpful to me. He gave me a sense of things I wasn't aware of, focus about, familiarity with some of the repertoire. Because he had come out of, you know, more rigorous kind of study, and passed that on to me, which is good at the time.
Yeah, you needed somebody to sort of that had some sort of apprehension of that. I mean, you'd already mm-hmm. studied with the I forget her name, the person
Rhett who studied Dalitz, with, yeah.
mm-hmm. studied with Aaron Scheer. So you were already in the system, so to speak. You already were using. Was that the method that you used? Was the Scheer method?
It was. Yeah. Yeah.
So you grew up with that.
That book. Somewhere I've still.
Been. I still have that book. I don't know because I was with Adam Holzman for mm-hmm. undergrad, and that's what we used. And the thing that shocked me most was in book one, where Scheer finally tells you that the goal of everything is performance. And I had never thought about that before. I'd always thought of this as like art or something, but I was like, the goal is to perform. Like, ugh, I don't, what have I got myself into? But that book one is just all words. If people haven't seen it, the book one is, there's no music in it at all. It's blue and there's no music. Yeah. And then the green one is where you start playing these very rudimentary sort of free stroke.
My cover was red, I'm pretty sure. Oh. But, you know, they show the shape of the nail and you get one, you know, bing, bing, you know, kind of thing. It's right at the beginning.
Oh, you didn't have his picture. Ours was like a guitar and then a picture of an old man and then a guitar.
No, it was, but this was in the 60s now. This was a long time ago. Oh, so they may have recovered it, you know. I mean, so, and I was quite young. So this was also beyond formative to study with her. My father was a guitar player and taught me everything mm-hmm. that he knew quite quickly. And he loved classical music. So they quickly found me a classical teacher there in Richmond. But so I came in, you know, my father was a finger picker. Mm-hmm. But of course, Greta completely adapted my technique to classical because I had more of a wrist that was bent down and was playing like this.
Yeah.
Not banjo style, but that kind of playing. And she, of course, she's like, you've got to straighten your wrist and all this, which was difficult. I remember that, you know, being frustrated when I was about 7 or 8, like, wow, I've got to change the way I play. And I was already playing kind of sophisticated, even though with the non-classical technique. So I'm so glad I got to go to her.
At that age, your father, I was going to ask. Yeah, I didn't know he played guitar.
Yeah, he was a folk player, and he had a really good ear. And I think, and so does my mom. She was a singer, too. She used to sing professionally some, and just a beautiful voice. And my father, I always remember watching him play. My uncle played, too, even better than my dad, and sang. He had this great tenor voice. So they had these family sing-alongs. But when a song might go from major to minor, I might go to the sixth chord, a cadence on six instead of one, and you could just see it in his eyes. He was so attuned to the emotion of harmonic change. And I was aware of that because I could hear it, too. And so when I started studying classical, he would coach me. I'd be playing these simple pieces by Sor or whatever, and he would talk about phrasing and like, maybe, you know, you slow down a little bit here and, you know, get louder here and speak, you know. He would have these great ideas that, I mean, as a very young boy, I would think, wow, this is so deep, you know. And so this also is with me today. Even some of my phrasing today, I remember back to being just like this child and having these ideas of music as a deep expressive vehicle, and even simple little melodic fragments could just be infused with potential, like emotional potential. And that's another thing I don't often hear, you know, in the guitar world is like, it's a very technical instrument, isn't it? Very difficult to play. And you have to spend so much time practicing and controlling it because it's a tough one, right?
Yeah.
And it tends to keep people in the realm of execution and technical execution. And it's not always that easy to bring back deep expression, not only formally, which is another thing that is, I think is difficult to take an entire piece and make a formal organization that's deep, but also on the micro level, like moments, like little turns of phrase, things like that, where it's poetic. This is what I've tried to do always ever since those moments, those early moments with my dad, you know, to try and make everything about music, the things that I write, the things I play, like poetic on multiple levels. That's what I try. Of course, do you succeed? Some days it all sounds like crap. You know, you just can't control everything, but that's my intent. And otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it now. There would be nothing to hold my interest if it didn't have like this deep kind of spiritual, emotional potential of communication. Why else would I bother?
You know, you bring up a point that I always bring up, which is, you know, whenever you're playing a piece by somebody else, I used to think, oh, it was only Bach. There's always one part of a Bach suite that I just cannot play like other people do. There's always one thing, and usually it's a line or just a measure, but there's one thing where I'm like, well, there goes the whole 15 minutes.
Yeah, I know.
And
I know that feeling.
I wonder, you know, because you compose, I compose, you know, now over the last 10 years I've composed, but one of the reasons I composed was because I have vocal dystonia. I don't know if you're in the same boat. I don't think you have any injuries like that or anything like that. But when you talk about our struggle with constantly being up against the ropes, technically, I mean, you compose more than maybe anybody for the guitar. And does that have something to do with the fact that you feel like you can be more attuned to that, you know, emotional expressiveness? When you don't have to constantly spend the better part of the day, you know, working on passages of other people's music?
That's a really good question. But actually, no. I mean, I started composing as soon as I could play, you know, when I was six or something. As soon as I could figure out even how to write it down. I don't even know how I learned notation in the very earliest stages, but I would begin writing stuff down. And for me, it's a personality thing. I like to create things, whatever I'm, you know, my interests are, or, you know, like when I got into mathematics, the first thing I wanted to do when it started to make sense to me deeply is I thought about things I wanted to write about. So I wrote a series of mathematical articles. I like to create, and it's the same idea. I like to move into territory that's creative. And actually, my pieces that I find some of them monstrously difficult, and apparently so to others, because when I hear the way they play them, even good players often, sort of, you know, wow. I mean, not John Williams, he played Sunburst quite well. This was just a quick digression.
Yeah.
But when I met Williams in Cordoba, we were there at a festival, and I was playing in the duo temporarily because he was only coaching ensembles. So I went there with a friend and we were reading through stuff. And he heard me play Sunburst in an afternoon concert, and he wanted to have the music. And I thought, great, I haven't even written it out yet. I had just recorded it in LA before coming to Europe. And I said, yeah, when I get it, you know, when I go back, I'll write it down, send it to you. And he was saying, well, yeah. And he said something that was very humble. He said, you know, it looks really tricky. I don't know, you know. I said, come on, you know, you're John Williams. I mean, you have no trouble with this. But I thought that's so charming that he expressed like, I don't know if I can really do some of that stuff. Because, I guess, the astronauts or whatever. I said, you got to be kidding. He goes, no, you know, sometimes other people's patterns can be difficult to realize or something like that, he said.
Yeah.
And I always thought about that. That was fantastic. And of course, once he looked at it, like, of course he can play it. You know, it's like, not a problem. Anybody in the world could do it. Good God.
No, you know, I don't think so.
Brilliant technique. But
that brings up the point that sort of plays into the idea that, you know, the other part of it too that's brought up a lot is that, you know, this is a particular instrument in the sense that every composer in every piece as long as they're composing at a certain level technically, will present new challenges, where that's not always the case with the flute or the violin or even the piano. There's a sort of standardized way that you play. There's a right hand and a left hand, and they do certain things, and composers compose to those objectives. That's not what happens with us. It's like every composer has it, you know, like you're talking about those little left hand, those things. I mean, that's something that if you have left hand issues,
right, it's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. So I think it's sort of, it's interesting, that point that he made and that you had.
What's fascinating, I think the issue goes deeper than that, because most instruments have a pedagogy that's quite linear and easy to understand. And that's why, as difficult as the instrument may be, like piano can be terribly difficult, of course, but it's linear. It's a line. The keys are laid out in a line. It's not difficult to understand how to write for it. And that's why composers have no problem writing for piano or flute or even violin, which is essentially a linear instrument. It's a line. I mean, you know, you do double stops, occasional triple, but that's not the rule. Guitar is a two-dimensional, we play on a two-dimensional plane. So we're making geometric shapes continuously. There's not another instrument except our cousins like lute and things like that. But our instrument is unique. Very difficult to understand for a composer that doesn't play the instrument, because there you have to not only be aware of geometric possibilities in the hand at always unusual positions, but getting from one to the another. Like, this chord might be possible, this shape might be possible, but you can't get from that one to that one. I mean, you've got to do something, you know what I mean? Almost all good guitar compositions written by non-guitarists, they were coached by guitarists. I mean, it's like almost probably all of them. I've know so many colleagues who have worked with composers, and that's the punchline. They've worked with the composer to create the piece. I mean, I can't think of any exceptions. And so a lot of the really fine repertoire is written by guitarists just for that simple reason. But so back to the original question, I find my pieces very difficult. Now, a lot of, in the guitar world, a lot of people associate, they seem to be much more aware of my simple pieces. I've delighted in writing simple pieces for students. And there's a lot of them, because I wanted to write things in a more contemporary style. When I say contemporary, I don't mean like, what I mean is relevant to current styles, instead of sounding like they were written in the 19th century. You know, all the Soar and Giuliani and Carulli that students are forced to play. Often, you know, I tried to write things that they would, you know, resonate with a little more, and that's what I've done. But a lot of the guitarists are unaware of my more technical pieces, and there's a lot of them for some reason. I think because a lot of my simpler folkloric or charming pieces push a button and become very popular, and so they get a lot of notoriety, but many people made the mistake of thinking, well, that's how he writes all the time. No, it isn't. I mean, if you just listen to some of the quartet pieces I wrote, you know, things like that, that gives people a sense of another dimension. So when I'm writing, you know, for myself, or, you know, I don't write to my technique ever. That's the thing. I, you know, when I'm finished composing a piece, I have to then learn it. And I'm always a little bit frustrated that, wow, this is, you know, I have to then practice it just like I would anything else, Bach or anything. So I have to figure out how to make it work. Now, I do have the luxury, if it's like too tough, I can try to recompose it, not just to simplify it, but to make it more reliable for the execution, you know, so it doesn't interfere with the musicality. But that's not often. Usually I, you know, create it. But I let the music dictate what needs to happen, not the guitar. And that's, of course, a lot of composers approach, especially guitar composers in the steel string world, for example, they'll approach it completely with the technique as a ceiling, their technical ability as a ceiling for the composition, because boom, they bump up against that. Well, like, how could, but I don't write so much on the guitar. I write half on the guitar and the rest in my mind, probably more than 50% in my mind, because the piece itself becomes a form and has a life of its own and its own needs, and I can't let the guitar limit what the piece needs to do. Of course, it has to limit it. There's certain, like if I want a 7-note chord, not going to happen. So there's obvious limitations for any instrument, but I make sure the counterpoint and everything is satisfying, and I will keep recomposing it until I find a way to make it work on the guitar. But still, it doesn't mean it's easy. And I always, you know, realize when I'm learning the pieces, it's like, damn, you know, I have to practice these things because I wasn't considering my technique in the composition. I was considering the needs of the piece. And I think that's a really important distinction, and it's not necessarily ubiquitous in the guitar composition world.
No, it's not at all. Well, there's sort of three ways that it could be done, right? There is the composing at the guitar, which I think more or less, when you're writing your music, it sounds like you come up with it in your mind, you're walking around, you're singing things, playing things on the flute. No, I'm just kidding. But you're just like kind of, you're walking around, you're thinking about the music, and then you're sitting there and you're composing it at the guitar, right? You're not going into Sibelius and composing there and then writing on the guitar. Because when I've done that, that's where I end up kind of running into walls that sometimes I can't even get over.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, this is like straight 16th notes for 2 minutes. Yeah, like I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
So I don't know, what is your approach there? Do you generally compose more or less without, you know, just considering that ceiling that you were talking about? Do you compose at the guitar mostly?
Again, probably about half. I like to be kind of playing through.
But you don't write it down first, is what I'm saying. Like, you don't have an idea, write it down, and then consider the guitar.
Well, there, at some point, what I often do, and I try not to do it any one way because I really struggle. When you do it, the more years you do something, the more of a trap it is to do it formulaically. Like, hey, that worked, let me do that again. And it captures, you know, painters, authors, so many artists get caught by this, and I feel it tugging at me all the time. Especially as you've written hundreds and hundreds of pieces, you realize, I sometimes look at a passage, that's really similar to something, and I realize, yeah, that's like another expression of a phrase in another piece. And I realize, so what? You know, I mean, it's like you can, themes and variations, you can take an idea, and I often do that now for fun. I'll take something I've already done and move it somewhere totally differently. But at some point, I often go to the computer and begin notating, and then just putting it in, looking at it, maybe I'll even use MIDI to play, even though it sounds awful, that's not really that helpful, except mm-hmm. with ensemble music, but just kind of look at it, and then maybe quickly, you know, just start typing in possibilities, different phrase endings, you know, different sections, putting them together to see. It's just another tool. So I do that midway sometimes. Sometimes this all happens very fast. I'll write a piece in a couple days, 2-3 days. Mm-hmm. Sometimes not. Sometimes it'll take weeks. But when it happens fast, it's just I'm back and forth. I have put the guitar on my computer. But usually what happens is I think the most formative work at night when I'm sleeping. Because when I'm working on something heavily, it becomes an obsessive, not necessarily pleasant phenomenon. And it's like the music is running through my head and it's forking and moving in different directions. And then I'll be dreaming it. I'll be kind of sort of sleeping, but thinking in a controlled way. Like I can still control my thought. It's this bizarre thing that's been happening in the last 10, 15 years. Hmm. Where I'm asleep, but I can continually think and control the thought process. But the only reason I even know that is because sometimes my wife would like poke me and I'd immediately without pause go, what? And she would like, she said, you're snoring like just a maniac. And I'm like, no, I'm not, because I'm thinking, I'm clear. I'll tell you exactly what I'm thinking. And she goes, no, you were dead asleep and snoring. But she said, when I touch you, you just said, what? Like you were completely awake. I said, well, I thought I was awake. So it's this weird thing. I'm sleeping, but my mind does not turn off. And it's exhausting sometimes. But anyway, with music,
that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that, well, first of all, I feel sorry for her. And second of all, yeah. second of all, I feel like that you must be very tired if you're thinking all the time.
Yeah,
at night. But it's just, I mean, what are you going to do?
Well, I don't know. I can't really turn it off. I know it's
yeah.
But that started really happening when I got into mathematics, because I would work. Just I would think about these things 24 hours a day because they were interesting and deep. But with music, it's valuable. Then I have to get up in the dark so I don't, you know, wake my wife, go in the other room and, you know, record some of the new ideas. So I've got to put on my iPhone and like catch some of the stuff that's flowing through my head. A lot of the work gets done that way, because that when you're laying down, it's dark and there's no distractions.
Yeah.
You can really think through stuff and work through stuff. And I find that to be very, very helpful.
Well, the mathematics thing is something that I noticed too. You're part of this society, this 999 society, and I didn't. I've kind of heard about this you know, marginally in my, I am not part of a triple nine society.
It doesn't really do anything. Yeah.
More of like a single nine society, maybe double some days, depending on how much I drank, but you're part of a triple, which is a society for people with high IQs, right? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
And basically you guys are just sort of writing articles about mathematics and about sort of things, connecting it sometimes to the real world, which I think your last two articles did. Something I didn't bother reading them. I was intimidated by reading them because I understood what where they were coming from. But one was about a bowling ball or whatever. So I think you guys are just dealing with the realm of physics and mathematics in ways that, you know, you just want to be able to talk to other people that know what you're talking about. I don't think it's like a elitist thing. It's just sometimes it's like a musician talking to a musician. A lot of my friends want to talk about music.
Like
my friends want to talk about music all the time. Well, I live in Brooklyn. I got a bunch of friends that think they know everything about music. They don't know anything. You know, and they want to talk to, and I just don't. Sometimes I'm like, you know, let's talk about something else. Let's talk about the Mets or something. So I totally know. I can understand the impetus for you guys to sort of get together and have a safe place where you can talk about those things and not have people, you know, either not follow or become outright hostile. How did that come about, and how was that fostered, especially because you were, you were a music major the whole time? How did you sort of maintain that level of study and discourse?
Well, you know, it's just kind of the way, you know, I think we're just born with different brain wiring, different abilities. In a way, it's meaningless to me. I never really, in the sense that it doesn't change anything. It just changes what kind of things interest you or what you think about. And ever since I was a kid, I was just fascinated with science. I thought about it all the time. When I was six, I would ask these crazy questions. You know, my uncle loves to tell us. When I was like three, he was, you know, my favorite uncle at the time, and he was like, "Hey, what do you want to talk about?" Because I love the way he played guitar. He was the one that played guitar. And, you know, what do you want to talk about, Andy? I said, atoms and molecules. And he just looked at me, you know. But, like, where at 3 years old did I even learn about that? I don't remember. But I would, anything about science, I would, like, sponge it. And I would think about it continually.
Were you frightened?
So it was kind of, no.
Were you frightened when you were young of atoms and molecules?
No, I was fascinated. I wanted to go down to the, and I still do. I'm fascinated by the idea of where the origin of everything. Like, if you go zoom in more and more and more and more and more until you pass by the atoms and molecules, at some point space and time theoretically break down. That's like, I'm still fascinated by that. And if you expand out in the universe, at some point, what do you find? I mean, is the universe circumscribed? Does it have a boundary? Nobody. And the idea of infinity is the idea that people think about and get a headache, but it's, you know, you can't wrap a human mind around this. Same thing about you go smaller forever. You can't probably go smaller forever. So these ideas are very deep, and they're at the foundations of physics. So I was always interested. So how it happened, it was, I didn't know. I thought everybody, you know, I noticed that none of my friends wanted to talk about this stuff. You know, I learned quickly, well, okay, you can't just really talk about this stuff. So, and that's frustrating.
Yeah.
And so I was always reading magazines, you know, Scientific American, and there was a great magazine called Omni.
Oh, my dad had it. I was always intimidated by science and never really got into it.
Yes, not for everybody.
But my dad had Omni magazine. I used to just like look at it and wonder.
Yeah, that was a good one. It was actually, you know, it was for the masses, but it couched, you know, complex ideas sometimes in very charismatic ways that, you know, you could really, you know, if you had any interest at all, it would work for you.
He would tell me that he's staying. He would say that he's staying at the Omni Hotel, and I would think, it's a hotel completely Omni magazine.
Right. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
But anyway,
there was a test in it. You know, that's okay. When I was like 18 or 19 at JMU, there was a test in there by one of the members who had made an IQ test that you could take and then, you know, send, and they would grade. You know, and he was a member of the very new Triple Nine Society, and most IQ tests are completely inaccurate. for high IQs. They're focused to be at most accurate around 100, and the error rate increases pretty dramatically as you get either higher or lower. So they can't accurately measure. There's a lot of misinformation about this stuff. So he wrote one that was focused higher, and by using it, a lot of people with known IQs, he was able to, you know, make sure it was accurate.
Right. There was already a sort of ground bedrock of your
right. Exactly.
You got a high.
So and there was nothing you had to know. There was nothing about knowledge that you had learned. All they were was like puzzles. Every question was a puzzle, like turning geometric shapes, and you had to pick what the fourth one was. You had three these shaped diagrams, and then there would be maybe a A, B, C, and D of the fourth one, but they weren't easy. You had to really go deep because, you know, complex kind of algorithmic puzzles, and some were verbal and some were spatial, that kind of thing, you know, things you could write down on a page. So I was just intrigued. I was like, wow. So I just did it for fun, and I thought, oh, I'll mail it off. So when I got the results back, I was eligible to join. I said, why not? Sure.
Yeah
sign me up. So I've been ever since, but it happened by chance. And yeah, that's all. So it's not anything. I don't focus my being there. It's just I have like an intellectual need to think about things that really most people don't want to think about. Like I would sometimes get excited about a mathematical concept and tell my wife, and I say, I'm going to just be real simple. I will tell you for 5 minutes, and I'd watch as the glaze would form over her.
The thing we put these eyes, women through is just
terrible. I know. So I'm like, okay, forget it. You know,
we're just like, listen to me. I'm a genius. Please listen to me. Just know I don't have anybody else. Yeah, yeah. Made me here.
Yeah. Throw me a boat. I got to tell somebody.
There's nobody else to tell. I think that obviously that's going to, you know, play into what you become, which is this, there is a spirituality that runs through your work, and you know, not for lack of a better term, but you know, through your brand, the way you're presented to the world, there's a sort of there's a lightness there, and there's sort of references to, you know, Buddhist thought, and sort of, you know, a lot of your titles are sort of you know, at least aware of Eastern religion and stuff like that. Is that, do you think that those two things have a relationship?
Yeah, sure. It's all mixed up. I mean, none of that was ever on purpose. I'd never thought, you know, I've never tried, even though marketing is important and we actually spend a lot of time on social media because you have to make a living as an artist. But what I think I never did with my art is like, I'm going to write a piece and make it popular. Like I'm going to model it. I mean, I only write the sounds I love. That's it. Period. End of story. I mean, that's it. And if it doesn't work, I accept that. But my demand was that if I'm going to be an artist, I'm going to be an artist all the way on my terms, and I'm without compromise. And I do what I like, and I don't give one damn
one fuck.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. I don't care what anybody else thinks.
Yeah.
Whoever they are,
academics
don't care. And I mean, that took a long time to really cultivate the freedom there. I mean, when you get your first bad review, you're pissed off and hurt, and it's usually by someone who's talentless and jealous.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. So I mean, this happens. It happens to everybody. But you know, you have to learn to deal with this kind of rejection on all levels. But at some point I realized why. You have to think deeply why I do this. As I mentioned before, I do it because it is a spiritual thing. It's a communication. I have ideas I find joyful and amazing, sometimes sorrowful, and I find them touching, and I try to craft them in a way, you know, using all my abilities. Sometimes, you know, all the things I put into my mathematical articles, those same kind of complex ideas, even in a simple piece, there's things in there that, you know, I aim like types of complexity that is not complexity for complexity's sake. That to me is a no-go either. But if you think really deeply about music and things and form, and just place one note in a different way or change the rhythm slightly here, you can have a form that I think has enormous potential. Bach was the master, the genius of geniuses. I always like to say Bach is a greater genius than Einstein. And I firmly believe that. If you study, and I like
you've studied both, yeah.
Yes, and as time goes on, I'm of course amazed. Everybody's amazed by Einstein. He changed the world. He changed. He's where did he get these ideas?
Why do you think this is interesting? Because I wouldn't be able to make that claim. I don't have any sort of physics background at all. But why do you think Bach is at least slightly smarter than Einstein?
Well, because of the depth of his creations. Because as you get to know pieces by Bach more and more, and study them, and experience them, and realize the multifaceted layers of form, like in all Zoom levels, and the elegance of construction, coupled with this, to me, the greatest emotion of any composer I know. Some people think Bach is clinical, and he's often played that way, I think to his detriment. But some of the slower pieces, and not even just the slower pieces, but there's just heartrending emotion if it's approached that way. And I think Bach was completely aware of it. This whole idea that Baroque was kind of a period where it's not romantic.
Bullcrap.
That is like the deepest, most like pathos, like this beauty. And it, you know, he was focused on the infinite. He said everything he wrote was for the glory of God. And, you know, I'm not terribly religious. And that was a time when that was, you know, that was a foundation of society. But I think the greater implication of that statement means that he was aware of the infinite and his music had a connection to the infinite. And that's the point there. Now, nothing about religion is that he was, I think, in touch with something beyond the mundane,
right?
And with this, incredible capacity for creation. So anyway, I can't justify that statement, but I'm always truly awed in the ancient sense of the word when I'm confronted with the music of Bach. The older I get, and the more I get to know it, it's just, yeah.
Well, the implications, like all art, the implications become clear as we age of what's happening. And that's sort of the thing. It's like when you approach it at first, it's pretty. When you approach it at second, it's hard. When you approach it at third, you're bored. And then and then eventually you start to realize that, this is actually something that's doing something that science, people like Einstein Einstein famously really loved Mozart's third violin concerto. Hmm. And, you know, that he played it, I think, he was a violinist, I think.
He was a musician, yeah.
Yeah, so he would look to that as sort of this area that he was looking at it from an outsider's perspective with so much reverence, I think. Yeah. And that had to be connected to the fact that the limitations of our scientific understanding of the world around us weren't able to do what Bach was able to do, just by simply using the medium of music. You know,
that's well put.
I would like to say I'm a big fan of Einstein, but you know, I don't read. No, but anyway, so go. As far as that stuff is concerned, you also, you know, a lot of what you write is in major. Is that fair to say? Is it a major?
Is in
key?
Major.
Right.
I would probably say the majority's in, maybe more than 50% would be in minor. I would guess that's interesting. I wouldn't, and many of them are modal, especially some of the intermediate pieces I write for your students are
modal.
Often.
Yes, definitely modal. Yeah.
So, I've never actually checked. That would be interesting to see. I mean, you know, guitaristic keys, of course, there's a lot in D major. You know, you drop it down to D and it just kind of plays itself. We have keys that
I 100%, that's always been my
minor,
favorite key.
Nice, E minor. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So in a way, I try not to compose too much, but there's probably a whole lot of work in D major, you know, and D minor, just because it makes more complex things playable and the range kind of is perfect. You can write some really heavy stuff that way. But I also written pieces in B major and things like that. I like to improvise, I'll often improvise in keys that are not guitar friendly for the challenge and for the refreshing outlook.
And
often in development sections, I will modulate and sometimes get into keys that are usually not expressed too often in guitar, except by jazz players who will play in any key with equal, fairly, not equal comfort, but they can really move around. You know, tail of jazz, or do that song a minor third up. Okay. You know, it's like, that's what you learn.
That's their bread and butter. If they can't do that, they
basically can't. That was my training.
Yeah.
When I was doing bebop, you know, this is the whole thing. It's like getting your fingerboard knowledge at the level where you can, and your chord knowledge where you can do that. So that's really helpful also on the classical for composition. You know, it's like I'm not like sailing uncharted waters the way I think a lot of classical composers are when they really move, you know, even with their training, they're really not taught like jazz players are. It's like that's sort of the calculus of harmonic study. And I think even classical, they get there, but not as deeply. I mean, I have to say from doing both, I would have to say that.
They get there harmonically, not, would you say that maybe the classical musicians are not getting to as deep of a level harmonically, but perhaps they're able to get to a deeper level melodically? Or just, I mean, what do you, because I know that extended harmonies are a huge part of jazz, particularly jazz mm-hmm. guitar. So thinking about that in terms of that versus, yeah, a classical approach, which is more or less a melody and then counterpoint. Yeah, I mean, what do you think? Why do you feel that way? And I don't mean that in a challenging way. I'm just interested in why you, and I think a lot of other people feel that jazz allows for a deeper exploration of music.
Okay, let me clear my throat. There, you can cut this out. I was looking for a mute button. I don't see one, but I wanted to, starting to get froggy. Oh, there it is. There's the mute.
Yeah, it's a little microphone. Okay.
There it is. There it is. Yeah, it's a provocative thing to say. I know, and I don't necessarily mean it that way. It's just from my perspective, that's what I've noticed.
Yeah.
And I don't mean it in a disparaging way against classical composers, because I could also say negative things about the jazz world. I mean, there's deficits there as well, I think.
Yeah.
So the reason jazz, like someone that really goes deeply into jazz, because sort of the pinnacle of bebop, for example, if you think of Giant Steps by John Coltrane, if most people have heard that bee-da-dee-da-dee, where he goes through three keys, moving so fast between the keys, and then improvising in 16 notes, through these keys with complete freedom. This is, you can't imagine anything that hard. So jazz developed, you know, into modulating continuously and being able to handle that in an improvisatory sense. Mm-hmm. So these guys would practice in a way where they just were warriors in terms of understanding and conquering quick harmonic movement and being able to function within this, just this almost, it's not anarchy because it's actually very structured, but just the quickness of movement of these modulations. So their brains just rewired to deal with, wow, like let's move through some changes. And of course not all jazz is like that. Like Miles pulled it back when he started doing cool music.
Yeah.
But still all these guys he was playing with were like formed during the period when harmony and modulation ruled. So they brought all that to their craft, even when the harmony was simpler. I mean, yeah, the harmonic movement in the cool era was somewhat simpler, but they still had this melodic ability just to move around in ways that you couldn't have gotten there without this other kind of study. So when I would study, and you know, I mean, Giant Steps is one of my studies, you know, I actually learned Coltrane solo on guitar. I did it in my junior recital undergraduate. I played with piano, drums, and me. And I played Giant Steps and I did Coltrane solo just for the technical aspect of it. And I continued to work on learning how to improvise that, you know, over that piece. But all of these kinds of things, and then making like Joe Pass-style chord melody realizations of music, and you'll take a jazz piece which has, you know, some nice harmonic movement, and then, like you said, extending the harmony or reharmonizing. That's a big thing to do, to reharmonize a melody. So you're always thinking about how can harmony be used to make it more interesting, spicier, deeper, you know. It's just a heavy way to study, and to do it on guitar means you've got to know the neck. You got another instrument in a way classical players never do. So, and then you couple that with composing, then you have at your disposal this palette of harmonic resource. And I just think the reason I said that, that classical players don't, because they don't go through that process.
No.
They go through some years of studying scores and working with a teacher. And yes, of course, they learn, you know, modulation and they learn harmonic extension. But it's still not as far evolved. It just can't be unless you do that for years. And I'm talking, you know, these guys work really, really hard, both the classical composers and the jazz people in their respective fields. And unfortunately, there usually isn't a heck of a lot of overlap. There's, you know, they're both developed very highly. But what I've wanted to do is bring them together. You know, it's rare for me to write in a jazz style. I do once in a while. Like, you know, I wrote Blues for JD. I just did a YouTube video of it recently and actually finally learned the piece. I know Bill Kanagiser recorded it on one of his records in the Classical Cool. But I had never learned it. I wrote this decades ago, but it's in a true jazz style, kind of a Joe Pass blues. Really fun to play. But usually all that jazz training is in there. It's just implicit. It just, it's in potential. It gives me options that are not. See, sometimes you hear one of my pieces that's contrapuntal and sounds fairly classical, but if you really look at it and I, you know, extract some of the chords and things that are happening, you'll see these hints of extension from the jazz realm. But I never wanted to make it sound jazzy, you know, unless that's my intent. But it's there in ways that people often miss. They miss a lot. And there's, you know,
No, they do. I know that they do. And yeah, I guess the thing is, the big difference would be a chart. You know, you're not with your music, you're not reading a chart, you're reading, you know, a score. And you know, with the jazz, it's more or less like I'm actually this is funny we're talking about this, cuz I don't play jazz, but during COVID, actually before that, I have a whole bunch of hand things happening. And they all know about it. I'm not going to bore you with it. But basically, I was recuperating with a left hand issue after like an operation. And the way I did it was I just did the chords and all the different forms, because I never learned how to play jazz. And then during COVID, I just, for like my warm ups, I would just go through all the, I don't even know what you guys call them in jazz land, but I would do variations on an F chord. So F, F major 7, F 7, F 13, F 9, F 11. And then I would do the same thing with the D chord. And then, so today's the first day I'm actually putting my friend who's a bassist. I'm going to go up to Long Island City, which is right above there's a bridge that connects Greenpoint where I am in Brooklyn to him. And I'm going to go try and play. I'm going to try and play jazz for the first time in my life.
Excellent.
In his apartment. But he was in a quartet of mine, and I've been begging him to do it. And I was like, and he's like, man, just, can you just do some charts of your music? And I was like, I tried, and I was like, it's just not really working that way. Is it cool if we just read some stuff from the real book? And I'm like, pissing my pants. I'm so excited to do it. And he's probably just like, this sucks. And I'm just like, can we play, you know, let's play Stardust. It'll be fun. And he'll be like, dude, buy me some beer. But you're right. I mean, he's thinking on all these different levels, and I'm just excited to be playing a G9.
Oh, that's fantastic, though. I mean, it is really fun. It's a great journey to go down. And, you know, I always tell, I don't teach privately anymore, but, you know, I have this Andrew's Den, you know, this whole subscription website that I created, and my wife and I created just for the pandemic launch. We actually went live about the same time the world shut down. So I got a whole bunch of subscribers right away. And it's really fun. And I've talked about some of these things in some of the videos. I've done hundreds of videos already for the site. And one of them was, you know, learning things like that. Like when you do jazz or anything like that, you're learning these chord forms, don't have an ultimate goal. Like, when I learn all of this, then I will play. It's like, learn one new thing and use it. Have fun with it. You got to make it like a enjoyable, creative moment, like day by day. You can't, like, you know, once I go through all the modes and all the chords, then I will play. No, you got to make it musical all the time. So this is awesome. Like, whatever you know, go make some music, you know. And this is the way to do it. Otherwise,
well, the way that's the only reason I was able to really do that was 5 years ago. I started having to prepare my children, students, for their high school auditions, and the high schools all have jazz programs. They don't have classical ensembles. Yeah. So I started learning those chords with the kids, and then eventually it became that. But yeah, like you're saying, this is now years in the making. This sort of the ability to be able to play all those different things. It's not something I was under the impression I could learn it in a month or two or three. And it's like, no, it's kind of something that just sort of eventually I got comfortable enough with it to where I'm like, okay, well, let's just go see, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's the way all things need to be.
It's a deep pedagogy. I think some classical players don't realize how intensive the study is to learn jazz. Like you said, anything else, it's just like.
Well, you actually, you one of the people that you work with a lot is, and tell me if I'm butchering his name, is W.A. Matthew?
Oh, Matthew. It's just his name.
Just Matthew. You know, that's the way you say it. That's
he goes by Alaudin Matthew. Yeah.
And he has a strong connection to jazz. I can understand why you work with him, because he used to arrange for Duke Ellington, and he now, and not now, but for the last, whatever, 50 years, has been doing solo instrumental piano music that's definitely taking from the same influences that you take. And you must be influenced by him yourself. But can you tell me about that relationship?
Well, I found him. He, I had a piece on Windham Hill in the late '80s, one nylon string guitar, and it was the last guitar sampler record they made. They used to do these piano samplers and guitar samplers. And you might be too young to remember, but the '80s was a time when instrumental music was selling vast numbers.
Yeah, my dad had the Windham Hill with the Leo Kottke and all that stuff, right?
Yeah, Am I right? All these artists. I think, did he end up with Windham Hill? I'm not sure, but that, because Kottke kind of predates that. He was pretty well known, you know, for his wild style. But during the 80s, that label Windham Hill became this just hot item. And, used to do tons of concerts recently in the last 10 years with Alex Degrassi, and he came from that's
who I'm thinking of.
Worldwide touring. And, you know, we have fun playing together, but he's an awesome musician. Not everybody on the label was great. There was sort of a lot of noodly stuff that was the new age music, but some were fantastic, like Michael Head, just like Alex Degrassi, and really deep musicians. But so I was lucky to end up, they chose one of my pieces for the sampler of all these people, and it just sold stupid amounts of records. Like, those days are so gone, you know. But because of that, I got turned on to a record by Alaudin Matthew. He had done a record for Windham Hill. He did one full record. I think Bobby McFerrin joined him on one track, just, you know, doing his Bobby thing, singing in the background. But there was something that I resonated with, like a spirituality, this openness, this depth of like joyful sound, the way he played. And Alaudin is an improviser. He's maybe one of the best improvisers I've ever met. So we, you know, developed a relationship over time. I contacted him, and ultimately I wanted to make a record and have at least one track with him, so rented a studio up in Sebastopol where he lives. I went up there, we just kept doing take after take of his totally free improvs. So it ended up, the record is like half of the record are these improvisations with him. And it was, you know, keeping me on my toes, because he's truly a master. So that was just the only project we've done together, but that was really, really fun. You know, I love to improvise, and I'm a good improviser. He's a master, you know, that kind of thing. I don't consider myself to be a master improviser. I enjoy it very much. And sometimes, my piece Home was a complete improvisation. You know, all the sections were there. I just sort of rearranged them, tightened them up a little bit, but the whole piece was beginning to end was improvised.
Wow.
Sometimes I get lucky like that. And a number of my pieces are like that, were improvisations. Yeah. But they're not all like that. You know, sometimes I play something and go, well, you know, would have been better if I hadn't even taken the guitar out of the case if I was going to play that. You know, I'm honest. You know, it's like I improvise in concerts sometimes, and sometimes they're really good. Sometimes they're just okay. And that's, you know, that's just where it is. But I enjoy it. It's like this, you're in the moment, this Zen approach. Like you have to be in the moment or it's not going to work. So when I think of Alaudin, I think of someone that's just, you know, on another level, that's beautiful to witness.
You and Dean's both, I don't know if you ever, but he would always start, right?
By
improvising.
Right.
And
he was a fine improviser himself. Yeah.
But that's a great way to warm up, you know, rather than just like.
There was a time I did that too. I would come out and improvise if I felt, you know. But then I stopped doing it. I would often improvise encores. that I kind of enjoyed that, because then they've heard everything I had to say with the compositions, and then I would come out and just play something.
Very personalized, like, love letter to the audience at the end there.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's the good thing about it. Well, I mean, we're kind of coming to the end, but one of the things that I really was drawn to after kind of looking at you for the first time in a while was you have been, most of your releases since 2018, all of your releases, I think, maybe there's one, have been singles. You've been releasing single after single after single. There's like 70, you know, singles released. And
every 2 weeks
that's,
for a while.
That's something that, you know, is unusual, especially for somebody who has been in this industry for so long. It's not something that is... you know, it almost makes you ineligible for a lot of Grammys or a lot of awards or a lot of airplay or coverage, but it's definitely something that they're going to have to catch up with, because it's certainly something that I'm interested in, is releasing the music as it comes out, because you never know what's going to happen, and you never know, you know, I have to wait until I've accumulated an hour of music to release it. It's sort of unrealistic, especially for a composer. What are your feelings on that? You obviously had to kind of go through that when you were making that decision.
Well, that was a very conscious decision, you know.
And imagine
my wife helps a lot, I mean, massively with marketing. You know, she's the social media presence. She takes care of all that, as well as doing the filming and the editing of all the videos we do for YouTube and for Andrew's Den. And in talking with some of the people I knew that were very successful on Spotify, I'd met some of these guys that were making actually... And they're not super famous. These are just guys in the guitar world, but they're making a lot of money on Spotify.
Yeah.
And my streaming was going up, but still, you know, streaming pays so little. And they were very generous with their information. Well, first thing you do is stop releasing albums. You release singles. And the reason is simple, because you can promote each single as a new event. You do an album, bam, you do some promotion, and then it's gone. Poof, nobody remembers. So he says, release them one at a time. Each one is a blast on social media and you know, MailChimp, whatever you're doing. Then if you like, make an album of those and now release an album. And you get another blast of everything. Now, I kind of haven't done that. I've just been releasing singles. But that's why during the pandemic, just recording here at home, doing all the work, filming the videos, doing the releases. And it was amazing how, you know, the streaming went up. You know, at that time, Spotify had curated playlists. They still have them. And if you could make it where they would put you on the curated playlist, your streaming would triple your income, because those playlists are big. They just, I don't know where they're playing, but they're just playing, so you make money. Well, Spotify is a deeply unethical company. I dislike them intensely. Unfortunately, they're holding all the cards in the streaming world. Like, Apple's insignificant, you know, compared to Spotify.
Right.
But they do some really bizarre stuff, and I'm not going to go into it here. But what they did fairly recently is they kicked us all off the curated playlist, like 95%. Within a month or two, bam, we're up. We're just all gone, pretty much. I only know a couple guys who are super connected. They're still there. I still have one or two on there through collaborations with other people, which, you know, cut streaming income a lot. So the internet is vicious, and it's always been, you know, for publishing, for music, for record labels, everything. It's been in complete flux. You know, the dynamic change level is just off the charts ever since the internet. It was always a tough business, but the internet kind of threw everything into upheaval in the music industry and other industries, but especially music as we know. So you have to constantly be readjusting. And that's this readjustment of releasing singles made sense at the time. And, you know, what we going to do, you know, is it that important now to keep doing that? Maybe that's still the way to go, but it's lost some of the necessity, because Spotify doesn't want to pay royalties. They can be clever at avoiding it. So, not a company I respect.
Yeah, I mean,
they're public now. They're public companies. They don't need to be nickel and diming these mid-level artists. And this is what they do. I won't even say what it is, but there's an article about Spotify from some years ago on the Rolling Stone about some of their behavior that everybody knows they do and they won't admit, but it's like bizarre. Anyway, worth digging up.
Well, I was wondering about that too. Oh, yeah. I recently was dealing with them and with CD Baby, which I think I must have gone public, because they used to be normal. And
really, because that's who I use for release.
That's who I use, and I was having trouble because I was unaware that when you release, I don't want to get into this too much, but I released something a couple of months back, and it was three pieces, and you know, about 16 minutes or something, and they called it a single, and I was like, it's not a single. It's like, it's three pieces. I've been working on this for like 2 years.
Yeah.
and they were like, well, it's a single. And I was like, it's not a single. Since when is a single three tracks?
Yeah.
And they're like, EP, no, a single needs to be a minimum four tracks. So I can't help but wonder if there's some sort of money thing going on. Because I'm like, well, you asked me and I said it's an album, CD baby. And why is it that you guys and Spotify are both just like, nah, get out of here, kid?
Huh. Yeah,
I don't know. It's interesting. So I've already become a little bit like, whereas I remember there was a guy, Derek Shivers, who used to run CD Baby. It's like a Pacific Northwest company, right? That's what it used to be.
Okay.
And now it's like I'm on the phone with somebody from, you know, another, no offense to other countries, but not from the Pacific.
Right. Which is not the best country in that case. Yeah.
Right. But anyway, I don't want to end on a sour note.
Start talking music industry. It gets to be a little bit.
We were talking about math and Einstein. There's two things we don't like. We don't like Einstein and we don't like Spotify.
Was that what we said? I don't remember that. Okay.
That's not what we said. But I've had Maestro. I've had the best time talking to you. I've loved you for years.
My
first album was the first Asada album my friend gave me. The first album I bought was that John Williams album, and I probably wore out Sunburst listening to, going to sleep at night to it.
Wow, after vivacious sleeping piece, you know.
I didn't care. I just loved it so much, and you know, you've touched a lot of people over the years in that way. So thank you for all your hard work. It's meant so much to all of us.
Oh, thanks so much. I really appreciate you having me. It's been a fascinating conversation with you.
Well, I appreciate it too. And hopefully we get to, you know, you think the COVID thing's over, so maybe we'll run into each other. I'll try and see you when you come to New York, which is going to
be there. That's right. And I think, is it March? I don't remember, but it's February.
Yeah, you
March,
can go. Well, if this is a little plug for John Olson over there, and everybody who works hard at the New York Classical Guitar Society, but you are going to be joining them this spring, I believe. So go over to newyorkclassicalguitarsociety.com or whatever it is, and
that's right.
Get that information and go see Andrew York, because you know, this is it'll be a pleasure to see you at that. Thanks so much for coming on, and we'll see you soon.
All right, thanks a lot.
That does it for my time with Andrew. I hope you enjoyed that. Make sure you go to brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. That's brettwilliamsmusic.com/support to support the show. We depend on your support. It's the only way the show really makes some money. I mean, you know, Savage is great, and you know, but really, you know, we need you guys to help us out. By us, I mean me. Please. It's a good time to do it. BrettWilliamsMusic.com/support for more interviews like these. And also, make sure that you go to AndrewsDen.com. That's AndrewsDen.com and SavageClassical.com. See you guys next time.